Good evening, everyone. My name is David Gunthner. I am the Senior Strategist for State Affairs at the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, and I want to welcome you to the first class of the inaugural edition of Mackinac Center for Public Policy's Candidate University. This is really a new program for the Mackinac Center where we do a lot of education programs for members of the public and come up with some niche programs that are aligned with that mission. And given that you are a very important audience as future elected leaders of our state, we want to make sure that we are providing programming that's informative and useful for you. I've been with the Mackinac Center almost 2 years. In fact, my two-year anniversary is coming up later this month. And prior to that, I had spent 11 and a half years with the Mackinac Center's counterparts in Texas, at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And we had a program that was similar to this as far as legislative candidate policy education down there, and really was valuable in helping to raise new issues for the awareness and to begin the process not only of getting legislators aligned, but also to begin to establish the camaraderie within the legislative classes. So it'll be interesting, given that we are all on a video screen as opposed to in the same room, what that winds up looking like, but definitely we're encouraged that so many of you are joining us for this experiment. As I said in my last email, this is the first time we've done something like this, especially online. If there are things about the format and the content that work for you, let me know. If there are things about the format or content that don't work for you, let me know. We want to make sure that this is a good use of time, not only for you in the future classes in this program, but also that we refine and improve it for the years to come. So at this point, we'll get into our first session of the evening. Joe Lehman is the president of the Mackinac Center, been a great leader not only in Michigan public policy, but also helping to improve organizations and build organizations that are effective champions for liberty and free markets around the world. So he developed a program, actually it wasn't, let me see, hold on, I'm trying to figure out how to share the screen. So he wants to talk to you tonight about seven principles of sound public policy and seven principles of sound governance. So I figure that was a good kind of overview way for looking at a lot of developing a framework for looking at public policy questions. So Joe, the floor is yours.
Very well. Thank you very much, David. And I am really delighted to see all of the candidates and potential candidates online with us tonight. And I want to say, I think you are embarking on a noble task. And I'm sure you know, as candidates, in talking to people, there are those who would say, why do you want to do that? Why do you want to run for office? Because the news is full of stories about how candidates get more than their share of abuse, and some of it's deserved, but every candidate gets abuse, whether it is deserved or not. And our founders of this country, which I still believe is the greatest country on earth, set up a system that required people like you to step up and be willing to carry out the functions of government. And so I'm just grateful that you're willing to take this seriously, learn from your peers and learn from others. And tonight I hope that these ideas from the Mackinac Center will do two things. First of all, I hope that these ideas will make you think of your role as a policymaker and future policymaker in a new way, and in a broad way that takes into account the all of the ramifications of the very considerable power the government wields. And secondly, I hope that it familiarizes tonight. I hope tonight familiarizes you with the Mackinac Center as a resource. And one of the things that I really like about this little talk, Seven Principles of Sound Policy, is that it's a popular talk with people no matter what political label they apply to themselves. The man who actually put these principles together for the first time is my predecessor at the Mackinac Center, a man named Larry Reed. He was the first president of the Mackinac Center, and he did that job for 20 years. And he was my mentor there for 13 of those years. And Larry put the talk together the very first time for the Detroit Economic Club. And at the time that I think he stopped counting, he had given the talk more than 100 times. It had been translated into dozens of languages. And he had person after person come up to him and say, you know, I didn't think I agreed with the Mackinac Center, but I don't find anything wrong with these principles. One man even identified himself as a communist. He said, you know, I'm a communist. I think I'm a careful thinker. I've arrived at that conclusion after a lot of thought. And I really can't disagree with your principles. So let's go. Let's talk about Larry Reed's Seven Principles of Sound Policy. And we'll have some time for your questions after I finish. But the first one to think about is that free people are not equal, and equal people are not free. Free people are not equal, and equal people are not free. Now, at first glance, it seems to run a little counter to what sort of what the prevailing notion is of what it means to be an American, doesn't it? We're taught that in America we're free. And we're taught in America that we're equal. In fact, the Declaration of Independence says that all men are created equal, meaning, of course, in the language of the day, they were talking about all men and women. And but let's dig into that a little bit. When we talk about free people are not equal, we're not talking about equality before the law. People are equal before the law. This is the notion that everybody should be judged as innocent, innocent or guilty based on whether or not they actually committed the crime. That's equality under the law. And this is without regard to race, without regard to sex, without regard to how rich or poor you are, without regard to whatever your personal creed is, without regard to your religion. You know, that's really what it is meant to be equal. But that's not the equalness that we're talking about here tonight. When we say free people are not equal, what we're referring to is income and material wealth. We hear all the time about wealth inequality and income inequality and social problems that may flow from that, and the way that this inequality can affect society. But what the first principle means is that people who are truly free are not equal in their income and material wealth. It shouldn't surprise anybody, if they've ever seen me play golf, that some people can earn a living playing golf. And if you saw me play golf, you would realize that people might actually pay me not to play golf. They might definitely pay me not to join their foursome. In fact, one time I was actually playing golf with a Mackinac Center supporter who invented me, invited me to visit him at his home. He lived on a golf course, and he actually was so appalled at my golf playing ability, he wondered why I would even dare embarrassing him on the course. And so I said, well, you did ask me if I could play, and I said I was a terrible golfer, but I would play. And so there are terrible golfers and there are people who can make millions of dollars. That's one way that people aren't equal, because people are not equal in terms of their talents. Different people have different talents. People are also different in terms of how industrious they are, as to how hard they want to work to pursue a goal. Some people set goals that are easy for other people to meet. Other people set goals that are as high as Mount Everest in terms of meeting. And so people are different in terms of talent and in terms of industriousness. And then a third way that we're different that's very basic is just in terms of savings. And I bet you all know people who were brought up in the same home by the same parents. I'm talking about brothers and sisters. And some of those kids grow up to be savers, and some of those kids grow up to be spenders. And you don't even have to say that one is better than the other. It's just that they're different. Some people find the full value of money by what it can purchase for them now. And others find the full value in money by what it might be able to purchase for them later. And so you find these differences, difference in talent, difference in industriousness, and difference in savings are such that if you can wave a magic wand and make everybody equal tonight, we would all be unequal again in the morning. It wouldn't take any longer than that, because we're different in our talents, our industriousness, and in our savings. And so free people are not equal. Now, what about the second part of the first principle? Equal people are not free. If you could, again, somehow make everybody equal, how would you do it? If you could make them equal in terms of their income and their wealth, how would you do it? The only way to do that is by force. There are some people who you would have to say, hey, you're working too hard there, or you're saving too much, or you're creating too many goods and services that other people want, and you're benefiting too much from that. You would actually have to make them unfree in order to assure that they're equal, and then even when they did turn out to be equal, they'd be unequal again by morning. So this is what we mean by the first principle of sound principle, the first principle of sound public policy, is that if you've got free people who are truly free, they won't be equal. And people who are truly equal, you can bet that they're not really free. Now, the second principle is something we've all experienced. What belongs to you, you tend to take care of. And what belongs to nobody or everybody tends to fall into disrepair. So we see this, we might see this when we rent a car. I bet everybody on the call has rented a car, and I bet either nobody or almost nobody has ever washed that car before returning it. Now, maybe you washed the car before returning it if you were afraid you were going to have to pay a surcharge for returning the car. Too dirty if you drove it through a lot of mud or something like that. But if it's a car you own, I bet you wash it. And if it's a car that you're renting, you probably don't wash it. And that's because what belongs to you, you tend to take care of. But what belongs to nobody or everybody tends to fall into disrepair. And this is known, and economists call this the tragedy of the commons. You often see this in areas where there's a public park set up, and they say, well, this belongs to all the people. Well, if it belongs to everyone, then nobody really feels like it's their responsibility to clean it up. There are people who would throw trash on the ground in a public park who would never throw trash on the ground in their own yard. And it's because they don't feel like they own that public park. And that's why governments have to hire people to go around and clean up after some of the litter bugs among us. You know, in the old Soviet Empire, the governments proclaimed that central planning and state ownership were superior, and they applied this through their whole economy, including down to the farms. And what was once the farmer's own food that he grew for his use and to sell to others, it became the people's food. Well, once they put that into place, once the farmer no longer even owned the food that he grew, people went hungry in the Soviet Union. What was once the entrepreneur's factory became the people's factory, and pretty soon the factories in the old Soviet Union were making goods that were so shoddy that there was no market for them outside of the borders of the Soviet Union. Now, the third principle is one of the principles you'll find printed inside the cover of every single Mackinac Center study. And it is simply this, that sound policy requires that we consider long-run effects and all people, not simply short-run effects and a few people. We have to think of long-run effects and effects on all people, not simply short-run effects and a few people. And the most, well, probably the biggest example of this I can think of in Michigan policy that was a very big matter before the legislature was just a handful of years back, the legislature and the governor got very serious about fixing the teacher pension system. The teacher pension system was $29 billion in the red, and that's because previous policymakers had never funded the pension system enough to keep it sound and solid for the teachers that had were expecting those pensions. And it's not the teacher's fault that they took a deal that was offered to them, but it was state government's fault and lawmakers' fault that they did not fund those pensions adequately. So we need to consider long-run effects on everybody, not short-run effects on a few people. The fourth principle is if you encourage something, you get more of it, and if you discourage something, you get less of it. And this is because people are creatures of incentives and disincentives. There's a great example that I'm old enough to remember, and maybe many of you are as well, that the first George Bush president, who was he immediately followed Ronald Reagan. He was elected in 1988. He campaigned in 1988. No new taxes. That was his pledge. But then he went back on that promise, and we got pretty big tax hikes in 1990. So Congress put higher taxes on boats and aircraft and jewelry and all of these things thought to be luxuries. They expected to get $31 million in new revenue from those taxes, but the higher taxes only brought in $16 million. And those industries had to lay off so many people that it cost the government $24 million in unemployment benefits. And so this idea that they could just tax more and more and more and get more and more money, it didn't work out. They discouraged the creation of those goods, and then they actually got less of those goods and less of the revenue tax. The fifth principle is nobody spends somebody else's money as carefully as he spends his own money. And I love the way that economist Milton Friedman laid this out. He observed that there are only four ways to spend money. Number one, you can spend your own money on yourself. And when you do that, you care how much you spend, and you also take care to make sure that you get good value for the money you spend, that you get a good product. Second, you can spend your own money on somebody else. So you still care how much it costs, but you don't care as much about the quality, because after all, it might be a gift for somebody else and you don't have to live with it. Now, you can spend somebody else's money on you. That's the third way. And in that case, you don't care how much it costs because it's somebody else's money. But since you're spending it on you, you at least want to get something good for it. And the last way, the fourth way, is you can spend somebody else's money on somebody else. Well, look what happens there. Since it's somebody else's money, you don't care if it costs a lot. And since you're spending that money on other people, you don't care if it's buying good stuff or crummy stuff. And that happens to be that fourth category, spending other people's money on other people. That's how a government spends all of its money. So the deck is kind of stacked against policymakers to make the right choices here, because they already have a situation where they're spending other people's money, not on themselves, they're spending it on other people. And that's the hardest way to spend that money wisely, yet that's how all government money is spent. Now, the sixth principle is simply that government has nothing to give anybody except what it first takes from somebody. And this is something that Gerald Ford said, although I don't think he coined it. He said that government that is big enough to give you everything you want is big enough to take away everything you've got. So think about it. Every time we say we need to grow government in order to solve this problem, we're creating an entity in government that, if it's big enough to give us what we need, well, it can only get those resources from the people. So it's got to be big enough to take everything that we've got if it's big enough to give us everything that we need. And the last principle is that liberty makes all the difference in the world. And I'll just illustrate that one with a simple mental survey of what the kinds of things we think of when we look around the world. When people flee one country to another, it's to make a better life for themselves. And one reason that immigration is a contentious topic in the United States is that so many people want to get into this country, because even though we've lost many of our freedoms, at least temporarily, we're still freer than the places that almost everybody else is leaving. And when I think of when will a great human accomplishment happen, like say a cure for cancer, or a cure for the pandemic of the COVID virus, it's much more likely to come from a country where we are free than it is from, say, North Korea, where people are not free to benefit from the fruits of their labor and their own gifts and talents. So those are the seven principles of sound public policy. David has a supply of little business cards that contain these principles. I've seen candidates hand those out before on the campaign trail to say things like, hey, these are my principles for governance. If you like these principles, you might like me. And David can supply you with those. And we also have a longer versions of these principles that summarize the talk that I've given here tonight. So at this point, I want to turn it back over to David.
All right. Thank you, Joe. I just want to keep up on the screen for a minute. Another little piece that Joe had written a few years ago about seven principles of sound governance. And just quickly, number one, tell the truth. One thing I've learned, having worked in government affairs for many, many years, is that you're only as good as your word, and that as soon as people lose trust in you, then you don't get to recover that. Be faithful and fair, embrace accountability, and insist on it. That'll be something I'll talk a little bit more about on Thursday night when we get into taxes and budget. Respect the governed and respect the government. Govern with humility. There are too many people who get elected, and you will quickly tell the difference among your colleagues who are there to do great things versus theirs, or I think the way I put it was to do something as opposed to be somebody. And you will get a, you'll get a sense of those. Please be people who are elected and spend your time in Lansing doing something. Serve the governed, not the systems or people of government, and acknowledge the nature of government and of man. Joe, do you have any quick insights on any of those?
No, I would just say that I was inspired by Larry Reed's 7 principles of sound policy. And when it comes to governance itself, the actual, you know, what does government do day to day when it's not literally passing laws? There are good ways to run a government, and there are less good ways. So we can provide, we'll happily provide anyone the longer version of all of these. And I've given that talk on governance several times. So thanks, David, for running through those.
All right. Well, I am not showing any questions in the chat field. For those who have joined recently, you can click Alt-H or the chat button in the bottom of the screen with all the people and pull open that, and we can address those later. I'm going to switch gears and get into our first specific policy topic, which is healthcare policy. We have Lindsay Killen, who is our Vice President of Strategic Outreach. She joined the Mackinac Center a few months before I did. She had previously been at the Beacon Center in Tennessee. And Greg George, who's recently come aboard as a policy advisor on healthcare. He's worked for Foundation for Government Accountability and for a number of organizations and legislative staff here in Michigan. So what I am going to do is pull up their presentation. And turn the floor over to them.
Thanks, David. So good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us tonight for a conversation about how to talk about healthcare reform on the campaign trail and how you could lead from elected office with ideas about increasing access, quality, and affordability of care for all Michiganders. So for those of you who may not be as familiar with the Mackinac Center, as Joe talked about, our mission is to advance liberty and opportunity for all people. And to do that, we consistently challenge government overreach and advocate for solutions that empower people to reach their full potential and pursue their dreams. But to do that, we understand that many people around our state and around our country are concerned about whether they will be able to access the supports that they need to do that, particularly when it comes to their welfare and the welfare of their loved ones. We know that many people are experiencing long wait times to receive the care they need, they're watching their premiums skyrocket, and they're walking away from visits with physicians questioning whether they're even receiving quality care. And that's a real scary thing. Polls across the country have consistently shown that healthcare ranks as the top issue on the minds of likely and registered voters. Here's a recent poll published by the Kaiser Family Foundation, which shows that it's the issue of most concern for Republicans, Democrats, and independents alike, topping all other issues, including the economy, education, foreign policy, energy, and the environment. This poll was actually published in February, so that was just before the COVID public health crisis heightened across the state, so these numbers are likely to be even higher now. So I'm going to turn it over to Greg, and he's going to explain some of the particular healthcare concerns on the minds of voters, what might be causing them, how they can be addressed, and how you can message to these issues effectively on the campaign trail.
Thanks, Lindsay. So before I get started, I want to commend you all on taking the steps to run for elected office. As David mentioned, having worked on campaigns and with grassroots groups and then working in the Michigan legislature with the current and past speakers of the House, I understand the task before you is both incredibly challenging, it's exhausting, but it's also rewarding. And that was all before this coronavirus kept us all at home. So let's just get right into it. When you're discussing healthcare policy with your neighbors and constituents, and later as lawmakers with your colleagues, it's really important to remember that healthcare access isn't just simply about having health insurance coverage. This is certainly important, but there are other important prerequisites as well. In other words, limited availability of healthcare resources is a barrier to accessing care for Michiganders, and this can lead to poor health outcomes. So as you'll see on the slide before you, the first graphic on the left, physician shortages may mean that patients experience longer wait times and delayed care. This is particularly important in many rural areas of Michigan, but also important when patients need access to specialists. There are essentially two schools of thought when it comes to healthcare provider shortages. One view is that we face a serious physician shortage that's likely to worsen in the coming decade without changes, and that demographic changes like an aging population requiring more care and retiring physicians and a continued population growth are going to intensify the need for more physicians. The other school of thought is that the U.S., we actually have an adequate supply of physicians, that our problem really of supply and access can be attributed to just a maldistribution of where physicians live and where they're serving. Regardless of which is true, shortages do exist, and there are several ways of addressing this problem in a free market way. And so if you look at the middle image, it illustrates the point that resources are more prevalent in communities where residents are well insured, but the type of insurance individuals have matters as well. So Medicaid patients, for instance, experience access issues when living in areas where few physicians accept Medicaid. A recent study found that only 71% of providers accept Medicaid, and that's compared to 85% who take Medicare and 90% that accept private insurance. So getting individuals covered by government healthcare does not truly solve the problem. It's more complicated than that. And if you look at the final image, it discusses the fact that healthcare facilities in Michigan are actually limited in the types of services they can offer and how many people they can treat by arbitrary government barriers. And these barriers decrease access, increase costs, and reduce quality. And on the next slide, in almost every quantifiable way, David, can we get to the, there we go. So in almost every quantifiable way, healthcare costs have grown substantially, including total spending, per capita spending, and as a percentage of GDP, any way you look at it. As the image shows on the left, healthcare spending in the U.S. during 2017 was $3.5 trillion, and on a per-person scale, it's about $11,000. And by 10 years later, the costs were expected to climb to $6 trillion, and roughly $17,000 per person. So healthcare premiums have significantly increased in both the individual market and in employer-sponsored insurance. Additionally, enrollment for those without subsidized insurance on the federal exchanges has been decreasing since 2016 as premiums have had sharp increases. So because of this, it's understandable that America has anxiety over healthcare. It's just not surprising. And I'm sure all of you have heard from your community issues that they have with healthcare. And according to Gallup, I found this pretty interesting, 55% of Americans in 2019 worried a great deal about the availability and affordability of healthcare, which topped the list of Gallup's poll for the fifth straight year. And another interesting point with the Gallup poll is that the consistency with which healthcare has remained a concern is insane. So while other issues have varied in their degree and they go up and down in terms of how much Americans care about them, Americans have worried a great deal about healthcare for 18 straight years. This angst stems from several places, and I'm sure you've heard every single one of them. higher and higher costs, lack of focus on primary care, increased wait times, accessibility issues, provider burnout, and surprise bills. If you move and look at the picture on the right, at the red box, you'll see that Michiganders, and for Michiganders, the price tag is especially high for patients and taxpayers supporting the tremendous burden of financing a ballooning Medicaid population. Michigan's expansion of Medicaid, which is called Healthy Michigan, was projected to cover approximately 470,000 enrollees. And now that number is roughly 700,000 and just continues to rise. So as we look at the next slide, you'll see kind of how we at the Mackinac Center kind of view healthcare reform proposals. And it really boils down to four things. And this is kind of the lens we use. Does it strengthen the patient-provider relationship? Does it encourage new options and choices? Does it save patients money? And does it increase transparency? Now, we know that a lot of healthcare reform does require action at the federal level, but our state-level playbook has several forms that can take place that can increase access, improve quality, and make insurance more affordable. So on the next slide, you'll see first that Michigan should repeal its certificate of need laws. Now, certificate of need laws require those looking to offer certain medical services to acquire certain devices or open or expand particular facilities. They have to first obtain authorization from a regulating authority, which prohibits healthcare providers from entering new markets, making changes to their existing capacity without first gaining the approval. And this has happened since 1972, where Michigan's been among states that restrict the supply of healthcare. This is kind of a high-level description of that. Next, Michigan should repeal unnecessary licensing and scope of practice laws. So scope of practice restrictions prohibit healthcare providers licensed in Michigan from practicing to the full extent of their education and training. Recently, Governor Whitmer offered, in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, executive orders. And some of those executive orders suspended some of the scope of practice restrictions for nurses, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, nurse anesthetists, and pharmacists, and really opened up kind of more access to these folks. Additionally, her order suspended licensing restrictions that prevented high-quality nurses and doctors and other providers located outside of Michigan who are already licensed and trained and had licenses in good standing for practicing here without first going through the hoops of getting a Michigan license. So removing these unnecessary licensing and scope of practice restrictions will really do a lot to relieve stress on the overall system during emergencies, but also during times of normalcy, because it'll create a much larger pool of providers for patients and Michigan folks to pick from. Third, Michigan should expand access to telemedicine. Now, telehealth is a much broader term that encompasses telemedicine. This essentially describes the remote delivery of healthcare services by various providers to their patients. So usage of this has dramatically increased. There's no doubt I've actually done this since the pandemic hit. And it helps reduce the spread of the virus and flatten the curve. But there are more benefits even during times when we're not in a health pandemic. It eliminates distance and transportation barriers and allows patients and their providers and other specialists to connect using technology. Providers can use telehealth to remotely monitor their patients' conditions as well, and then offer advice and prescribe medications. With telehealth, patients can have immediate access to communicate with their primary care provider or other specialists to help manage those conditions. So expanding those services, we can really increase access to those providers, especially to those that don't live in the same community and even those top doctors who don't live in the state. So I want to kind of go into the next part, which is expanding So we're going to expand short-term limited duration plans and expand association health plans. Those are the final two. So small businesses are really on an unlevel playing field, and larger companies just have more flexibility and they can offer more affordable tailored coverage because they're exempted from additional regulations. So AHPs, as they're called, they level that playing field because they allow small businesses to pool together with the bargaining power of a single larger company to access similar affordable options so they can attract the same sort of talent. And this is pretty relevant because there are significant disparities in high costs, and less than 30% of small businesses right now offer health insurance, which has dropped, I think, from around 49% as prices have increased. And so compared to the roughly 97 or 98% of large employers who are able to offer insurance just because they get better rates. So easing the restrictions on AHPs are going to make it easier for small businesses to come together to provide high-quality insurance for their workers. A federal rule change actually has allowed for that flexibility, and we're waiting for the result of a court case that's being decided to see what flexibility is going to remain and whether or not we can extend it all the way up to the maximum of the federal rule. Next is short-term plans, and they're exactly kind of what they sound like. They're short-term temporary insurance plans that provide sort of gap health coverage for individuals and families for a limited period of time. They can be purchased at any time, which is unlike other plans that are available in the individual market, which restrict enrollment to open periods and or following like a life-changing event. So coverage usually begins within a few days compared to other medical coverage that can take several weeks. And because short-term plans are not subject to all the same federal regulations, premiums are much more affordable and insurers can offer more customized choices. Michigan law currently restricts access to these plans when on average they're nearly 60% less expensive. So I kind of want to close out here with how you can talk about the issues. And so we recognize you have a lot on your plate and that there are a lot of other priorities that dominate your day-to-day work. And we hope that the information shows the value that we can provide to you when you do need resources and information on healthcare policy and reforms. And when you do, just know that we're going to be here to help you get that information so that you can be successful. All right. Let's see. So the Foundation for Government Accountability, where I also work, one of the things that we do when we're researching reforms is we message test what messages work with voters so that you can be effective when you're communicating messages of free market reforms to your constituents. And so the list you see before you are the top results of various polls on healthcare reforms that tie directly back to some of those reforms that I was just discussing with you. First is, and you'd be happy to steal these and use these however you'd like. First is more choices. Voters want to see that you're open to more choices for high quality providers, regardless of where they live. Voters want to see that affordable health insurance, they want to be able to know that you are supportive of affordable insurance that's right for them and their families. They want reforms that save patients money. They want reforms that make it easier for small businesses to purchase affordable insurance for their workers. And they also want to help preserve resources, which ties back to the Medicaid expansion argument. They want to help preserve the resources for those of the truly needy, because they want to make sure there are resources there for other priorities like education and public safety and infrastructure and the things that you'll all deal with as elected officials. So thank you again for letting me join you this evening. And I'm going to turn it back over to David and Lindsay and all of us for any questions you might have.
All right. Well, thank you, Greg and Lindsay. I have two questions that are in the chat room. If you have others that have been sparked by the conversation, please feel free to go ahead and throw those in there right now. First question is in relation to the slide looking at the growth in healthcare costs from $11,000 per patient in 2017 to the forecast $17,000 per patient in 2027. Does this have anything to do with an aging population?
Yes and no. Of course, costs do rise when you for patients who are older, but that has always been the case. And though the population has a disproportionately high or increasingly high number of elderly patients than it did, you know, in the last 50 years or so, at this point, that is not the primary driver of those skyrocketing costs that we're seeing. The driving factor really is essential health benefits. Those are this sort of wraparound package of benefits that were mandated through the Affordable Care Act that all approved plans had to include. and they're vast in terms of what insurance companies could provide or you know could offer in the past. They have to offer these very robust standard plans and all of this coverage. And many in many cases, the patient doesn't actually even need it. For example, if you're a 22-year-old, very healthy athlete in college, and you want to, but you know you need an insurance plan. Your insurance plan will also include neonatal care. And things that just don't make sense for you. That's true in many other cases because of essential health benefits. And essential health benefits are expensive for insurance companies to include in all of their insurance coverage. So those we call them EHBs. EHBs have been the primary driver of those rising costs, and that's why you see, particularly since 2010, the costs had been moderately growing over time, of course, but then took a gigantic growth curve after the passage of the Affordable Care Act. But Greg, you may have some additional thoughts there as well.
I think you covered it pretty much. Yes and no is the answer I was going to give to you.
All right, and second question is, if you accept out-of-state licensing, you are accepting the standards of other states?
Yeah, I can see that. I think that was Michael's question. Yeah, Michael, so I actually had the same sort of apprehension about it when I started to look at what that all meant. And so when I started to look into licensing specifically under the, like a healthcare provider, nurses, doctors, pharmacists. A lot of the education, training, and testing is all, and boards are all done at this national level. And so while there are small differences in state standards, and when we present the reform, we also make sure that they are similar. So there's a little more detail to it. But the apprehension I can understand, it's really that it's so nationalized and almost entirely the same. In most cases, there might be some differences in continuing education requirements, but the training, education, the boards, the residencies, those requirements are very, very similar. And so accepting licenses of practicing physicians who have gone through and are licensed somewhere, the license is in good standing and it's not under review or hasn't been suspended, those are, in our view, a great way of opening up providers. It also allows someone who travels to and moves from Michigan to Florida to maintain access to the same physician they had back in Grand Rapids or, in Midland.
Yeah, I think there's a broader conversation to be had, not just with the health professions, but also broadly on occupational licensing. You find some of these licenses and the standards that are in place and requirements and such are essential for public health and safety, but there are others that it winds up being more of a few players in the industry writing their own particular rules and using it as a way to limit competition and to force people up to the highest buyer. I think generally with the healthcare question, our view is one that people should be allowed to practice to the extent of their medical training, and that if someone's capable of providing basic primary care and they can they've had the education, they've had the training, and they can get the liability coverage they should be allowed to help with the solution. I was in a legislative hearing back about 3 years ago where someone said that allowing nurse practitioners to provide like school physicals would wind up leading to a case where someone hang out their shingle and do brain surgery. And it was such a ridiculous concept that an insurance provider would actually provide liability insurance for someone who obviously didn't have that level of training that the legislator on the committee who was a physician got up and left the room and didn't speak the rest of the hearing because of just how embarrassed he was by that particular point of view. But we will move on. Next question. I guess we'll before going to the next question, are you in favor of license reciprocity?
Yes, but with some caveats. What we don't like to see is license reciprocity used simply to increase costs for the practice of a profession. So, for example, there are some proposals and schemes out there that seem to be helpful on the surface, and that we embrace reciprocity as a good thing, but with them can come a pact between states to drastically increase the cost to get the license in the first place. They drastically raise their fees for the maintenance of the license and that type of thing. We do not support that. What we do support is the practice of professions across state lines. And to the extent that reciprocity agreements are established to protect that, we're supportive of that. But we don't want to see them turn into these money-making schemes for, bureaucratic agencies.
One more question. What do you think of a catastrophic universal policy that covers only cancer, diabetes, heart disease, only fatal diseases?
We are in favor of people being able to access the type of insurance that's appropriate for their needs. And definitely moving closer to the model that we see for car insurance, especially now in Michigan. I wouldn't have said the same a couple of years ago. But to the extent that individuals can assess their family situations or their individual situations and know or try to anticipate what level of risk they're willing to accept, and then have a plethora of options out there and available to them with varying costs and coverage packages and that sort of thing, we're very supportive of that. So should people be able to just simply purchase these catastrophic plans and maybe pay out of pocket or use HSAs or go to a direct primary care specialist for the other aspects of their care? Yes, they should. They certainly should. But that's got to be an individual choice. And unfortunately, right now, individuals really don't have that many choices. Some don't feel they have a choice at all. And Greg, go ahead.
And this is one of those congressional level changes that would have to happen with catastrophic insurance because it does exist. It's just limited. And right now it's for those that are under 30. And so there's just restrictions. So you have to either qualify for a hardship exemption or you have to be under the age of 30. And exemptions are usually you're homeless or declared bankruptcy. And so there's special, very limited select individuals can do this currently. But like Lindsay said, it just kind of limits options for other folks who would access cheaper insurance and pay more out of pocket if they wish. Because it would open up, like she said, the option to do this catastrophic plan with some sort of direct primary care relationship with a physician that covers those other things with like a monthly fee of some sort, which is a state level thing.
All right. Well, that's all the questions I have it showing up in the chat room right now. So if there's no other questions, then we will cut the program a few minutes early tonight. I appreciate everybody being here. We will have the next program on Thursday night of this week where James Homan, a director of fiscal policy at the Mackinac Center, and I will be talking about taxes and the state budget. I will also send you a link tomorrow to the page where we're going to be storing all of the presentations and PowerPoints and research materials from all of the experts in the program. So if you want to watch this over again, if you want to look at the slides, if you want to pull a report or two or an op-ed, all of that stuff will be compiled, and we will try to get each of these sessions updated the day after the program. And that it's not going to be a publicly available page, but we'll make it available to all of the candidates, and certainly hope that that will be a resource for you to come back to, not only for the times that you're able to attend, but if there's a Tuesday or Thursday night over these 3 weeks where you have a schedule conflict and aren't able to join us. But we really appreciate your time. And as I mentioned at the start, if there were things about tonight's program that worked well, let me know. If there were things that did not work well or need to be improved, please let me know. So we want to make this the best use of your time over these 6 nights. So thanks, everyone, and we'll look forward to seeing you on Thursday. Good night, everyone.